right. We need to finish up our historical sources section so that then we can move into actually telling the history story. We've already gone through the first three major sections of sources that we pull a lot of this history from, and they are. This will be good, even review, so that, you know, oral exam, I can even just say, hey, what are the four sets of sources that we usually draw Jewish history from? And you can say, oh, well, that's easy, because we went over this, and we reviewed it on multiple days. What would you say to that? What's the first one that we talked about?
Old Testament.
What in particular about the Old Testament did we specify about the time of the first century? By the time of the first century, what is something significant about the Old Testament in particular that we discussed? Do I remember? I hope so.
The Septuagint or the Masoretic text.
Yes, exactly. That whenever you come to an Old Testament passage in the New Testament, especially in the Gospels, you need to ask the question, is this from the Septuagint? Or is this from the Masoretic text? What's the difference between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint there? Then you need to be asking, is it theological or just linguistic? How does that impact the overall passage, or does it? Yeah, absolutely. The second set, I heard somebody say it in a slow voice. I think it was Beer. What was it?
Apocrypha.
The Apocrypha. Absolutely. There are three canons of the Apocrypha, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, as well as the Catholic. Catholic usually has 14 to 15 books. Depending on how you ultimately, sorry, the apple core was, anyway. Yes, I don't even know what I was talking about. Okay, what's the third set?
Pseudepigrapha.
Exactly, we talked about that last week. 66 books in the Pseudepigrapha, pretty much every genre you can think of, or last week, last class, every genre you can think of, stretching over a period of 1,200 years is when they were written, from Ahikar back in the 7th century BC all the way to the Apocalypse of Daniel in the 9th century AD. Primarily, though, they are focused in what time period? Even though they stretched that far, what's the primary time period? 200 BC to 200 AD. Absolutely. And that gives us a ton of the ways in which the Jews and the Christians were interacting with the environment around them, both leading up to the Gospels, concurrent with the Gospels, and shortly after. And that was the Pseudepigrapha. Give me one or two examples from the Apocrypha or the Pseudepigrapha that we have discussed in which there's a direct overlap between the New Testament and those documents. I gave six examples, three from each.
2 Timothy 3:6.
Yeah, exactly. Which would parallel what Pseudepigraphal book? What is it revolving around? Primarily two characters. Janus and Jambres, absolutely. And that's the name of the pseudepigraphical book, Janus and Jambres. So if you want to look it up, that's what you look up. What I was just doing, that's what your oral exam a lot will be like. You'll all be sitting in front of me. I'll have 10 or 15 of you in front of me. That'd be the whole class. I'll have probably like 9 or 10 of you in front of me, and that's what I'll do. I'll just start saying, hey, tell me about some overlaps between the Pseudepigrapha and the New Testament. Go. And then you'll have to say, okay, 2 Timothy 3. Do you know what about 2 Timothy 3? No, then who does? That's how it'll work. Does that make sense? So we'll kind of do those at the beginning of almost every class just to kind of get you familiar with the way in which that'll be working. Now we're in the fourth set, though. The fourth set is the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls is not going to be overlapping in the exact same way as the Pseudepigrapha and the Apocrypha were. As a matter of fact, you won't see pretty much any direct linguistic overlaps, but what you will see and why they are significant is because it is painting the backdrop of the Jewish people and their expectations in the intertestamental period. But in order to understand their full significance, we need to kind of just tell the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. 1946-47, three Bedouin shepherds, everybody know what a Bedouin is, they're a nomadic group, kind of in the region of Judea in that area. Bedouin shepherds, they're looking for their flocks, and some of them were in the caves. Well, seeing if any of their sheep were in caves, one of the guys literally just threw a rock into one of the caves. But what he heard was a crashing like pottery. They end up going investigating, and they find probably the most important discovery of manuscripts in the history of the world. Because what they found was in one cave alone, cave number 4, is the richest of all the caves that we have. And there were over 800 manuscripts preserved in there. And the reason why these were so significant is because they were in a controlled climate for all these years. Inside of a cave, keeps a constant temperature, sealed inside pottery. They are incredibly well-preserved manuscripts that date back to the 2nd century BC. Incredible find. Matter of fact, some of our Old Testament books, our Old Testament manuscripts, were literally updated by almost 1,000 years with this discovery. It's hard to overestimate how significant this stumbling of these Bedouin shepherds was on that day. In particular, it gave us some of the early manuscripts like we've already talked about. It opened up a whole new world of Jewish studies. We had heard references to the Essenes in Josephus, for example. And we knew that there was this other division, but we didn't know much about them. With the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we unlocked really their entire world and were able to peer into this group that we knew nothing of. A whole section, a third section of Judaism, which we'll talk about where their origin is and stuff a little bit now, but more in detail later. Who are they or who were they? There are so many theories out there, my word. How were they formed? Why were they formed? All those things. Some people will suggest they were a publishing house, which is just folly. I don't know how else to say that without saying, but anyway. A type of a boarding school. I've read one scholar saying that it was a boarding school they would send their Jewish kids to. A community of priests. Well, you know, I mean, that's about as general as you can get. But primarily, what is the common consensus is, what we can say affirmatively, is this was a schism, a sect of Judaism that intentionally divided itself from mainstream Judaism. More than likely, this was a community, I think, and we'll talk about this more later in the Hasmonean dynasty, I think in 2 weeks. Their existence is around from 140, around 140 BC, to 68. Now, why is the end date significant? We'll talk about the beginning date in a couple of weeks, but why is that end date significant?
Oh, the Jewish Revolution.
Yeah, right in the middle of the Jewish Revolution, where this community was wiped out by Rome, because they're in the region of the revolution, and they are, some of their documents, which we'll talk about in a moment, like the War Scroll, were very much anti-imperial, very explosive. More than likely, though, they were created. They separated themselves during the reign of the Hasmonean dynasty. Hasmonean dynasty, we'll talk about here in a bit, it was the result of the Maccabean revolts against Antiochus Epiphanes and the Greeks, and we'll go into all that detail by and by. But the creation of the Hasmonean dynasty, what happens when the Hasmonean dynasty is set up is the Jews are ruling themselves once again, finally. But the problem is their ruler, who claims to be both king and priest, is not from the lineage of Zadok like he was supposed to for the priestly lineage, and he's not from the Davidic lineage either. Therefore, their ruler, who's claiming to be king and priest, is an illegitimate king and an illegitimate priest, and he's claiming to be both. So you start to see different, in the Qumran scrolls, you start to see their primary focus on keeping the laws very rigidly, because a lot of mainstream Judaism at this time was not. They were being a little bit lax. Hellenization had already seeped in, but even whenever the Maccabeans rescued them from Hellenization, they still weren't keeping the laws like they should. So you'll see in the community rule, which is one of the scrolls, 1QS. This is kind of helpful whenever you're reading Dead Sea Scrolls stuff. This is what cave it was found in. This pretty much just stands for Qumran, and this is the designation of that particular scroll. But each of these also comes with a general name if they're more significant. So, for example, 1QS is also known as the community rule, where it defines how this community will function. And so then you have 1QM, which was found in the same cave, as you can tell here. 1QM, we know that also as the War Scroll, which is a fantastic... I actually made my Mark class read that last semester, because it really gives you an idea of what the Jewish people were expecting to happen if a messianic figure would emerge, but at least just by God's initiative alone. And that is a cataclysmic war, an eschatological battle in which God would use the remnant of Judaism in order to fight the Kittim, is what they're called in here, K-I-T-T-I-M, which is probably a veiled reference to Rome, the Roman armies. And that's how the Qumran people viewed themselves. They viewed themselves as that community, that remnant, that was going to be separating itself from mainstream Judaism, which had become corrupt and perverted itself. they are now the ones that are holding on to the promises of God, that are in God's favor. Even though they're not at the temple, they would say the temple's illegitimate anyway because of the way in which they're functioning as a community. Is this making sense? So in the community rule, you even see this in column 1, 14 through 15, lines 14 through 15, it says, "They shall not depart from any command of God concerning their times. They shall turn aside from his unerring laws, neither to the right nor the left." A strong emphasis on keeping the laws strictly. Why? Because the rest of Judaism is off the rocker. That's why. You starting to see how this community is developing? Okay. You go ahead and unravel that one yourself. That wasn't a pejorative thing. I wasn't challenging him. Okay, there we go. Okay. I'm okay with a pun. I'm just not okay with the challenge. Okay. How did they live? This is interesting to me as well. The best estimates of the Qumran community is they were never over 150 to 200 people. It was never a large group. It was this group that had gone out into the wilderness. They separated themselves. There is speculation, strong speculation, some that I even tend to lean toward, that John the Baptist himself was a part of this community for a lot of his life once his mother and father died because they birthed him at an old age. And that's one of the reasons why you see him feeling very at home in the wilderness, him being really rugged, very aesthetic, very, very bottom level base of what is allowed so that he can be living by the rigid laws that the Jews had gone away from. There's a lot of similarities even in some of the language that he uses with some of the stuff you find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That can be a fascinating study that you can look at. More than likely, though, they lived in caves. Yes?
I was just going to say, with that amount in the Essene community, what would you say, or where are you at on the population of the nation of Israel in general?
Oh, my.
Is that a significant portion?
No. Yeah, not a significant portion. The difficulty in answering that is trying to estimate how many Jews are in the entire diaspora.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how I can land on a number of that.
Yeah.
But whenever there's estimates that, you know, the city of Jerusalem itself could swell to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people at one festival,
yeah.
Then take 100 to 200 people off in a corner. And even the festival itself gives you somewhat of how influential this group would have been. Nevertheless, because of their location, they would have been known. And because of their explosiveness that they would launch even towards the Jews, they would have been known. But as far as influential things of that nature, I'm not thinking they're primarily that influential. But it does give us an insight into a particular community and the way in which they were responding to the things that were happening around them. And the way in which, it's not like they're totally different than other Jews, the way they're thinking, the way they're processing, the way in which God's going to intervene. So even though they're population-wise probably a small percentage, they still probably carry a pretty significant portion of the way in which a lot of Jews think. Does that make sense? At least similar trajectories.
Yeah.
Other question? Or?
Yeah. How do you feel, like, where do you fall in the whole, like, some people push that John the Baptist was a Essene, but some push further and say that, like, Jesus was really into what John was teaching, but he was like a radical. Probably got kicked out of that community, so a lot of the.
Who, that Jesus got kicked out?
No, not that Jesus.
That John got kicked out.
John got kicked out, but Jesus was a follower of John. Mm-hmm. And then once John died, he kind of took up the whole thing.
Yeah, a couple of things. Number one, I would say I'm always a little tentative about landing on any of this strongly because it's totally in the realm of speculation. Nevertheless, I do have some thoughts. Because primarily the question that it seems like they're even asking, whether or not it's even directly related to the Essene community, is what is the interaction between Jesus and John the Baptist? Did they have interaction? Did they compare notes when they're about ready to launch the kingdom, or did they not know each other? From the Gospel accounts, I think what we can say is at least two things, and yet we can only say them so firmly. Number one, we can say that it's not that they did not know each other; they were cousins. But where did their lives overlap? It would have been at Jewish festivals at best. And we don't even have any evidence of, we only have really one evidence of Jesus as a child on a Jewish festival, and that's in Luke. But we don't know about John the Baptist. We don't know if he did have some interaction with those festivals. The second thing we can say, though, is that whenever Jesus and John interact, depending on the gospel that you're in, trying to think of it. I think it's John. There almost seems to be a surprise interaction where John knows who he is, but he doesn't know who he is. And yet there's other gospels. Part of the other gospels, it's like, no, he clearly knows that this is the one. So as far as exactly John's understanding of who Jesus was before he announces his ministry, as far as collusion, we just don't have a lot of evidence. Jesus being a follower of John before he launched his own ministry seems to me a bit strange, not just because it's Jesus, but because I don't have any historical data to subject him to that. Nevertheless, what I can say is there is continuation of John's ministry by Jesus, and yet divergence as well.
Well, they take it from like a lot of Jesus' teachings. There seems to be a lot of emphasis on Jesus that he's taken from the Qumran scrolls. Like, I think N.T. Wright uses one of the accounts of Jesus. It's either 4Q or 5Q.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, because the Essenes were like, there's no need for the temple anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can be just as spiritual without the temple wherever you are.
And why would they say that?
Because it's become...
The Essenes are saying that, yeah, because they did not have the temple. Yeah, so go ahead, keep going.
But no, like, they take things like that. They take them, like, Borg, for instance, that's one of his big things that he hits on,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, Jesus is taking things clearly from the Qumran scrolls that nobody like.
See,
using, except for the Essenes.
And the word that bothers me there is the word clearly. To suggest that Jesus even was able to read the Qumran scrolls is really to go beyond what we can historically verify. We just cannot say that conclusively. But what I can say is that Jesus did share similar trajectories that the Qumran community articulates in their documents. I can say that. Similar trajectories. But that's totally different of saying that he is learning from them, or that you see what I mean? That's where I would challenge the historical methodology if Borg is using words like clearly. That's where I challenge his methodology and say you cannot prove that word. That word in and of itself is something that just goes beyond what we can even establish historically. What I can say is that there are similarities in trajectories, absolutely. Because what you have is you have a Qumran community that is highly critical of mainstream Judaism, which John the Baptist was, as well as Jesus. You can say that, and even the ways in which they are critical. John the Baptist coming in saying to the Jewish elite, you need to repent. The Essene community is going, you're darn right. And Jesus comes along and he says, yeah, he's right. So there is a lot of ways. Matter of fact, for example, we'll even talk about here in a minute, even some of the way that the church has developed sounds a lot like the Essene community. Probably good just to read that now. The community rule, 1QS. All who volunteer for his truth are to bring the full measure of their knowledge, strength, and wealth into the Yahad of God. They said, you're part of our community, then you need to bring all of your strength to this community and you contribute to it. You bring all of your wisdom to this community and you bring everything you own and we all bring it together and we function as a community. Sounds like Acts 2. Sounds like Acts 4. Now the question becomes, are the churches borrowing this from the Essene community? Or is this a Jewish trajectory that the Essene community has articulated that probably was also something that was reflective of a larger portion that was not living in the wilderness? You see what I'm saying by that? This becomes the danger in having documents, the good thing and the bad thing of having documents. Good thing is it lets us into the insight of the people that are living. The bad thing is sometimes we fall into parallelomania and we think, oh, there's a parallel he must be borrowing from. Just because there's a parallel. Matter of fact, we talked about this in New Testament intro. What is the phrase I used? Do you remember the phrase I used? When it comes to primary sources, bah, 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 bah. It's in my third lecture in that class. I can't remember what it's called now. It's the problem with inventing new phrases. Just use other people's. They're easier to remember. I don't remember. Basically, though, you have to have multiple levels of concentric circles to be able to establish whether or not a document that you're looking at has parallels with another document. You cannot just say, because I find similar things, you have to look at geography. Would there have been overlap in geography? Can I pinpoint where the Essenes and Jesus would have intersected at some point? You actually can come pretty close. Can I do time period? Yeah, you can come pretty close. You can come really close on a lot of these, but can I come conclusively on these? No, I can't. And as a result, I can come to the edge, but I can't jump all the way over into that. Does that make sense?
Would you just call that contextual overlap?
What did I call that? Do you remember what I called that? It's something like that. Email me and I'll let you know the exact phrase. Textual intersection.
Textual intersection.
That's what I called it. It wasn't anything profound. It was just a way of describing it. Textual intersection. How is your text and that text intersecting, not just linguistically, not even just conceptually, but geographically, chronologically, ethnically even? Yeah, absolutely. So how do they live? 150 to 200 people, probably in the caves, because the region in which they're living is an average temperature of 104. So the caves, natural air conditioning. They lived as a community that shared everything. Everything. So you could even take this to a theological level if you wanted to. If there is some overlap between the Qumran community and the Christian community in Jesus himself, which I'm not saying there isn't, because you can see clear trajectories where they're borrowing, they're both doing the same things in some very clear areas. You can take it to a theological level and just say, it doesn't surprise me that God at all points preserves what he desires. At all points. It doesn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all, theologically, that God would say, no, this community is going to be a model of what ultimately I want my community to be. Now the problem, well, we'll get into that later. There are some clear things, though, that they borrow from Judaism that Jesus completely contradicts. For example, the war scroll. They were looking, just like the rest of the Jews, for God to intervene through possibly a Messiah, but you actually find multiple traditions within the same community of Qumran about the Messiah, and we'll talk about this in a couple weeks when we go through a whole two-hour lecture on Messianic expectations. Sometimes they expect no Messianic figure to come and intervene eschatologically. Sometimes they expect one Messianic figure, and sometimes within the same document you see one and two Messianic figures. What is the link? We'll talk about it later, that Messiah is not necessarily what they're expecting. They're expecting God to move. That's what they're expecting. But the Qumran community definitely expected God to move in a very violent way. They would not have accepted Jesus any more than the Jewish elite did, because he wasn't doing it the way they wanted him to do it. All you have to do, read their scrolls. General divisions of the book. I am not going to be putting up every single one of the scrolls because there are tons of fragments, way outnumbering both the pseudepigrapha and the apocrypha combined. Nevertheless, I will draw four categories around what you find in the Qumran scrolls. Sometimes also too, this is just important. I always throw these up here so that you, if you ever run across these and you don't know, that's Dead Sea Scrolls. If you ever see that abbreviation, that's Dead Sea Scrolls. So I had somebody actually get really upset with me before because I'm using the designation BCE and CE. It's not because I'm against AD, you know, in the year of our Lord. I'm not against that. But you're going to be coming and interacting with that on many scholarly levels. And if you don't know what that is, or you have an allergic reaction to it, you need to get over it now. Otherwise, you won't be able to read a lot. Does that make sense? So it has nothing to do with my commitment to Christ if I'm using that abbreviation. Kind of like I was rebuked once because on a Christmas slide I put this, and I about had somebody freak out. Xmas, you're taking Christ out of Christmas? I was like, oh no, actually that's an abbreviation for Christos. As a matter of fact, what they would call it is the nomina sacra. You wouldn't even want to write out the full name because you're afraid of it. So what they would do is they would put an X and they'd put a line over it as a way of abbreviating the name without having to fully say it. So no, technically I'm actually more biblical, but we'll talk about that later. We actually will. We'll look in the Gospel of Thomas. I'll actually show the manuscript itself, and we'll get to even look through some of the handwriting difficulties of the scribe of the Gospel of Thomas and see where he's abbreviating some things. Sometimes he just abbreviates words because he's ran out of space on the line and he needed to finish the line, but we'll talk about that later. And he doodles at the bottom, and we'll look at that. It's going to be fun. But four categories that you can categorize the Dead Sea Scrolls in. Number one, you find canonical Old Testament scriptures in the Dead Sea Scrolls. As a matter of fact, there are copies of every book of the Hebrew Bible except, which book?
Esther.
Esther. Yeah, so Proctor's sermon would not have been well received in the Essene community. And the logic why was there. If you don't find God in it, Why would you have it in there? Which that was somewhat of a debate all the time. Plus, there's also collusion. I would even say this, on a political level, there seems to be collusion with the empires of the world more than criticism of them, and that's not something that probably would have sat well with the Qumran community in Esther. Because she's part of the problem for the Essene community. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just trying to describe the way they're thinking. Does that make sense? So there's probably good reasons why Esther didn't make it. But the fact that there are all the rest of them, every single one of the other ones, that's quite significant for our canon, for what they valued, etc. Number two, you find deuterocanonical scriptures. Deuterocanonical scriptures. This would be referring to the Apocrypha in particular. We do find much of the Apocrypha also present at the Qumran community. So you have canonical Old Testament scriptures, deuterocanonical scriptures. Then number three, you have extra-canonical scriptures. What would that be referring to? What category would be able to put fragments in there? The other one. Pseudepigrapha. The Apocrypha would fit in the deuterocanonical. The extra-canonical would be referring to the pseudepigrapha. We find a lot of the Old Testament pseudepigrapha in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then number four, the fourth category, and this is the one, honestly, the first three kind of give you an idea of what this Jewish community valued. The fourth one really reveals who the Jewish community was, and that's where you have sectarian documents. Documents that are specifically for them as a sect, as a schism, as a division of Judaism. And that's where you would find the community rule falling into place, the war scroll falling into place, documents that we do not have any parallels to in the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, or in the Old Testament. Those are the four divisions. And as we've already been dialoguing, you can see how these documents are quite significant for what we find in the New Testament Gospels, and yet the direct linguistic correlations that we use with the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha are not as abundant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yes?
Did we have a lot of the Pseudepigrapha and the Apocrypha and different things like that before we found the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I want to say that there was only maybe one new pseudepigrapha that we discovered, but the Apocrypha, nothing shocked us. Old Testament, nothing shocked us. Pseudepigrapha, by and large, nothing really shocked us. If anything, it was just updating our manuscripts that we already had of all those, and which was quite valuable. Because, as a matter of fact, the Isaiah scroll, it's parallel to our Masoretic text, was almost verbatim. It was huge. Because it was like, no kidding. This manuscript that was several hundred years earlier, earlier in the sense of, or later, what's the word? Several hundred years worse than what we found in the Dead Sea Scroll, almost was verbatim with what we found. That's great, because then it's like, okay, so our manuscript evidence that we have in this is pretty solid. We can land on this pretty good. Because even if we update it by 1,000 years, it's not major shifts. Nothing really shocked us. We had most of those, by and large. But what really was the treasure trove was the sectarian documents, in my estimation, for historical purposes. Does that make sense? Textual critical purposes, the first three are pretty significant. Historical purposes, the fourth division is quite significant. Other questions on that? So the four categories of sources, what they do is they help us develop the story. Now notice what major section of sources we have not discussed. What is it? What have I not brought up? What am I not talking about? Are there any other ancient sources in the first century that you'd be like, well, why aren't we going to talk about this to develop the history? Entire category. No one?
Are you talking about like Roman history?
Yeah, we haven't touched any. We haven't touched Josephus, Philo, nothing Greco-Roman related at all. That is intentional. We will deal with those later in a couple of weeks after we've gone through all the Jewish history. And I'll refer to Josephus at times, even Philo at times, but primarily I want us to be focusing on the Jewish sources. If you want heavy Roman sources, take New Testament intro. That's what we do in there. We dabble in the Jewish sources in there, but we go heavy in the Roman sources, and this class is the opposite. Make sense? Okay. These four categories, though, they develop for us is the story. Have you ever walked in on, let's say, a movie or reading a book or maybe even a conversation and you're halfway in? So you walk up, you pick up a book and you start reading it at page 150, or you go to a 2-hour movie and you walk in whenever it's already been going for an hour and 15 minutes, or a conversation that apparently has been going on for 15 minutes, you thought you could just walk up and be a part of it, and then you realize, this has been going on too long, I don't even know what they're talking about. What are some of the things you experience in that? Maybe confusion. Yeah. Are you reflecting on the conversations more than the movie, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
That's a weird moment too, isn't it? You know, you're like sitting there and then like, and you realize not only is it a conversation that you haven't been there for, but it's like full of inside jokes and you're just like, I don't even, why am I here? And eventually, what eventually do you end up just doing? Just walking away. Maybe even, or making a ridiculous joke just to try to break the tension, and you're like, okay, I'm out of here. Like, same with the movie. A lot of times whenever you even get to the movie and like, if you walked in halfway into it and then the main character dies and everybody in the theater is crying and you're just like, who cares? Like, you know what I mean? Because you haven't even developed the emotional attachment with the character. Sometimes that happens on accident when you're just reading a bad book. They just haven't developed the character enough and it dies and it's supposed to be a big moment and you're just like, I don't even feel any emotional attachment to this character at all. That's the same thing that occurs when we come to the New Testament and we haven't developed the story. Same thing. Same concept. Which is one of the reasons why I'm okay spending the next 2 to 3 weeks just developing the story. Just telling the story. And some of it may seem really dry. But the bottom line is, if you don't get the story, you're not going to get the inside jokes. You're not going to understand the direction. It's going to feel as awkward as a conversation that you walked in that's been going for 30 minutes that you're just not in part of. That you're just... You just don't get it. And you'll maybe make awkward jokes or you'll maybe make awkward assertions or speculations about the text just to make it somewhat fit. But in reality, you know it doesn't fit you and you don't fit it. So what are we going to do? We're going to tell a story. And we're going to start with the absolute basic. Some of the stuff we'll be going over in the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks will seem so remedial for you. Some of it you're just going to be going, okay, I've heard this like 10 times. Good! Because I believe in the Jewish proverb that repetition is the mother of all wisdom. I want you to hear it 10 times. I hope you've read the Apocrypha at this point, and it's like the fifth class that's assigned it to you. I hope so. I want it to be stories that you are familiar with, so that you don't feel like you're walking in on an awkward conversation or halfway through a movie. So for the rest of the day, this is what we're going to do. We're going to tell our favorite stories from Genesis to Judges. We're going to be hanging out in the pre-exilic period. Oh, my word. I'm going to quit complaining about this room is what I'm going to stop doing. Because I just need to get used to it. It's our cross to bear. Oh, I'm sorry. I hate that. Tell me your favorite stories. Genesis to Judges. Doesn't matter the order. Just tell me. Which one that you're just like, I love the story when? Go.
Jacob wrestles with God.
That's actually the one I have written down. That's one of my favorite. Why? Why is that one of your favorite? Yeah. It's such a cool story. I've heard several sermons on it, and they're just wrong. One of them is even by a guy named Calvin Miller. Deeper respect the guy. But he just gets the sermon. He gets the story wrong. Because they act like Jacob is intentionally going to wrestle God. He wants to just duke it out with God. And that is not the way the narrative is developed. Because right leading up to that, right before then, what you have is Jacob is afraid of meeting Esau. So he sends over his servants and he sends over all these different ways of appeasing Esau that he's developed over the past years that he's messed him over because he had the promise. And then he's by himself on the other side of the river and night comes and all of a sudden someone jumps him and they start wrestling. And what is Jacob thinking in that moment?
That's Esau.
And whoever wins this battle, probably it'll be to the death. And that's why Jacob is just, even whenever his hip gets pulled out of socket, he doesn't stop. He just keeps fighting and fighting and fighting until finally he gets the upper hand on the angel and he says, tell me your name. The angel says, no, I don't have to tell you my name. Why? Because you think that you're the one that's in the hierarchy here because you have the promise over Esau, but you have no idea who you're wrestling with. And it's this beautiful metaphor of what Jacob's been doing all of his life and what we do all of our lives. We wrestle with God until we finally submit to Him, and then He gives us a new identity. And from then, Jacob then goes on, and from then on, he is referred to as Israel. And what's interesting too is the very next time Jacob's name is mentioned, it's mentioned in the promise formula, for I am the God of Abraham and Jacob. And it never happened until after that moment. Oh, Beautiful story. What else? Tell me it's just you're afraid of the kumbaya moment more than you just can't think of a story. This is fourth year Bible college. Your Bible ex exam is going to be brutal if we can't come up with any of these.
Well, I like when God makes a covenant with Abraham. It's like a pagan covenant.
Yeah, Genesis 15.
Yeah.
And he splits, he's cutting the birds in half and he's walking between the blood. And fascinating thing there, though, too, is that God walks in between it with him. And you have this weird moment where, in establishing this covenant, God's saying, not only are you obligated to me, but I am obligated to you. Who does that? That's one of the things that's so fascinating about covenants that we overlook a lot of the time. Is that God is so sovereign in that covenant, he doesn't have to initiate anything. We cannot initiate a covenant with God because he is so much more sovereign than we are. He has to initiate it with us. And he did. And where Abraham walked, he walked in order to say, now you are mine and I am you. I've heard this. I don't even know if it's true. Even linguistically, I have a problem with it. But devotionally, it's beautiful. After that moment, one of the key breathing expressions in God's name is the ha sound, the Yahweh. And you almost have that kind of breathy feel, which I think also kind of finds its way into Ruach, which it makes a lot of sense whenever God is creating things by his breath. And he adds a ha to both Abraham and to Sarah to say, I'm embedded in you and you are in me in this covenant. It's just a beautiful moment of a wedding moment. Where God says, I will wed myself to you. Oh, that's nice. Other stuff? You have your hand up or just scratching? Okay, fair enough. I do that all the time. Yeah, go ahead.
I like the story of Moses being found in the bulrushes. Because it just shows me that God has a plan and that despite the very great odds, he can work it out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Other ones?
It's not really that deep, but I like it when Elisha calls out the bear's
mouth. Oh, gosh. You like that story?
I don't know why, but it's always stuck.
Man, I wish I could hear these stories again as a child. And I wish I could hold those while I'm an adult. I really do. I love telling a lot of these stories to my kids because they receive them in a way where we don't receive them. And they get it. They get the stories better than we do. They just get it. We're looking for the way to historically, pull them apart or theologically why I don't like what that says. And man, to receive these stories again as a child would be beautiful. Other ones?
I always really like the story of Samson. Honestly, that's mostly because of my last name. As a kid, they're so close. But as I got older, it was... especially since I went away from the faith and then kind of came back to the faith, it was nice to know that God can use crappy people.
Huh.
So.
You know what's kind of interesting about that is that Judges, as a book, especially the way it ends, it's actually probably imperial propaganda to solidify and justify the presence of a king. That's the way it ends. And they did everything that as they saw fit, for they had no king. And it almost is trying to tell these stories of the judges to say, see how messed up we were, but now how great we are. And we look at those and we say, yeah, but I'm still messed up. It's kind of interesting how something that even could be used as to prop up something that I don't think is even of God, and we'll talk about that in a minute, actually becomes a deep encouragement for us. I like that. It's called the power of the word of God. Very Bardian, but I like it. Yeah, Adam.
Hi. But I also really like Eglon. But those two are my favorites by far.
Eglon, very good. Genesis 1. Genesis 1, I wish we as a church would become as obsessed with creation in the right ways as the Jews were.
Well, my pneumatology paper was all from Genesis 1.
It's this powerful moment where the love and the tenderness of God is embedded into us, into his creation. Not just us, but everything.
Well, and it's super different. It didn't really become my favorite until I took a class in my last college on it was you're studying the myths, and yeah. the Mesopotamian myths are like super violent.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Irenaeus uses that as an, you may not agree with this, but that's fine. He actually uses the creation story as an argument for nonviolence and how one of the key characteristics of our God, as opposed to the pagan gods, is our God is not violent. And he points to the creation myths. He says, look at all the rest of them. It's usually this violent war where finally the one that conquers wins, or it splits a woman in half and part of it becomes, he says, and our God created out of nothing. Because literally, he said, our creation was not created out of a violent coercion or a force. It was created out of a desire from the one that created us to have a relationship with all of us. Oh, that's just a beautiful moment. And it's probably one of the reasons why they recapitulated a couple of times at the very beginning. Because the Jews just can't tell it from enough angles. And it's probably the reason why John's gospel begins in the beginning. It's probably the reason why Mark's gospel begins in the beginning. Something about creation. It's one of the reasons why Revelation chapter 5 or 4, whenever the elders throw down their crowns, and what do they cry out to God? We're worshiping you. Why? Because you created everything, and everything have their being because of you. Creation is a moment whenever the power of God is on display, as well as the heart of God. Because he didn't have to create anything. Man, I wish that's what we taught out of Genesis 1 more often. Instead of getting on our soapboxes about stuff that doesn't change the cross. Anyway, other stories.
I'm a pretty big fan of Noah.
Yeah?
And that whole debacle.
Debacle, yeah.
Everyone in the world sucks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to start over. And then, yeah, but it's like, but Noah found favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and what's crazy about that is that comes right after the creation. I mean, that's Genesis 5 and 6. And you're like, whoa. God's going, I did all of this out of my desire and love for these people. And look what they're doing. Look what they're doing. So, all of a sudden we have a major image that then we find its way into the New Testament. Where through water, God creates everything brand new. Oh, that's good. Other stories.
This one's kind of weird, but I really like the story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm-hmm.
From the sense of the prayer and the intercessory, I just really like that.
It's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, he flat out talks God out. Well, negotiates with God, and God is okay with it. It's kind of like that story, in a sense, disciplines me. Whenever I try to use a forceful hand against my kids, shut up and just do what I said. No, I mean, I can be a parent like a tyrant. I can be a parent like God. Whenever the heart of my children that I have prayed for and that they have put inside of them by God himself comes out in a moment and say, Dad, why do we have to do that? And if I look at them and just say, shut up, because I am who I am. That's not who God is. God says, well, let's talk about it. All right, fine. I love your heart, and I'll even change what I was planning because of you. If only 50 righteous. Well, what if you find just 30? All right, find 30. What if you find just 10? All right, find 10. What if you find... That's just so cool. I hate it whenever theological debates like open theism hijack such a beautiful story about the relationship between God and those that he loves. Man. Or the moralists come along and say... You know, see, we need to burn all the homosexuals, or, you know. I mean, you're missing the point of that story. Yeah, other stories.
In the wilderness, like the Ten Commandments, me going up and then coming back down, and the big golden calf being there, just the irony
of
how quick and fickle.
Yeah, man.
Just identifying with Israel in general and the desert.
And what Moses must have been thinking about that moment. I mean, good grief. That's just a brutal moment. We're going to finish up this kind of reminiscing next class. Because I think one of the things I think would be really helpful, don't do this class, but I'm going to have my Christian Life class do it this semester. I read it in a book by William Placker, in Unapologetic Theology. He just said it in passing, and I was like, I think I need to do that for myself, and I need my classes to do this, is you summarize the entire Bible in one page. And you're not allowed to go over one page. You summarize the entire Bible one page. And what you summarize, that's whenever you're in a church fight, a church split, you pull that page out and you read it and you ask, are we splitting over something in this story? That is the central of what God was pointing out with these stories. That's what he's driving at. As a matter of fact, the Jews would have loved this last 15 minutes more than they would have loved all of the first six class periods that we've had in here combined. This is what the Jews do. They tell and they relive their story. They tell and relive their story over and over and over and over. Why? Because their story defines who they are. Their story defines who they are. And the more you tell the story, the more it actually chastens you in the present to be what your story is revealing about who you are. But the more that we forget the story, the more we act like that the story doesn't matter, or that the story is too remedial, it's not profound enough, it's not interesting enough, because we are too highfalutin to be dealing with that kind of stuff. We've got too many degrees hanging on our door to be retelling the basic stories. Is the moment that you've forgotten who you are and you're no longer who the Bible wants you to be. God wrote, the reason why I think the canons are there, more than to give historical veracity for the legitimacy of believing in a rational God, whatever that even means, the reason why the canons were existed is so that it can remind us who we are. This is your story. It's why Justin and I were talking just the other day about the canon yesterday. And it is a legitimate reason why I don't believe we need to add anything to the canon, because my community put it that way. Some people will say, no, you need to justify it more. Give me more evidence, rational evidence of why I should accept these 27 books in the New Testament. No. My community selected these 27 books. I'm not. Are you asking me why I want to just throw out everything they did? Sorry, I don't buy into this hyper-skepticism that modernism shoved down my throat. I don't begin with skepticism. I begin with faith, and then I allow skepticism to be chastened and not run the show. Too often, though, we let skepticism become the thing that we worship. And that is anti-story, which is another way of saying anti-gospel. Why do you think the word gospel is something that was so embedded into the verbiage, the grammar of the early church? Good news. It's pointing to a story. It's pointing to a story. And so, remedial as it is, we will pick up telling the stories next class. And then we'll summarize it and then move on to the exile. Love you guys. See you in the morning.